This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be.
Winston Churchill had no hesitation about fighting to defend Britain during World War II as he rallied the people of England. Can we imagine such a moment for this country, free of ambivalence about confronting an enemy?
You will once again be fighting for our freedom. Not from tyranny, oppression, or persecution, but from annihilation. We're fighting for our right to live, to exist.
Independence Day, the 1996 movie Dream of a Nation rallied to the cause of saving the Earth from invaders. But in the wake of questionable results from the long conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan in this century, what would we fight for in the real world? This hour and for the rest of this week, we explore the sometimes loose talk in America about fighting for things and examine the lives of people who believe they have no choice but to fight as a consequence of the unrest right now in Ukraine and Russia. Is knowing what is worth fighting for a simple matter of having a brave heart?
What will you do without freedom? Will you fight?
This is Jim Rund from Lexington, South Carolina. I will fight for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the premise that we all have value. With 34 years of military experience, I have fought for our great country, and will do so again when called.
Coming up, we will take a look at how American values were tested after the 9/11 attacks. We'll get an update on some Republican Party primary fights that may set the direction of the GOP in 2014. But we're going to begin with two people fighting in very different ways. In a moment, we'll hear from a young man who believes he will be drafted in Ukraine and sent off to fight people he thought of as fellow Ukrainians until just a few weeks ago. But we're going to begin with a woman who fights for the rule of law by defending the very people targeted by international sanctions. Most recently, she's been getting calls from Russians sanctioned over the Ukraine crisis. But Maya Lester, an international lawyer and British barrister, made her career successfully helping Iranian, Syrian, Egyptian, and Burmese clients get off targeted blacklists from sanctions over the past two decades. Lester says she fights for her clients without spending a whole lot of time worrying about who they are.
Sometimes we're not in the business of saying this is a wonderful person and he shouldn't be listed, although very often that is the case. It's usually a question of saying that what has been put forward by the European decision makers is either incorrect or it's insufficient to justify including someone on the list.
In general, do judges in home countries or sanctioning countries care whether the country had a good reason for putting this or that person on the list?
Well, they feel usually that it's not appropriate for the court to interfere with the purely political sphere. So the court will be less interested in should we have sanctions against Iran or Zimbabwe or Russia. The question they are interested in is, has due process been afforded to this particular individual? And so that usually comes down to if the person has put in evidence that what has been said about them to justify their listing is wrong, then the court is often interested in, well, what does the decision maker say about that? And do they have any evidence to show that actually what they were saying is correct? Or are the reasons that they've given sufficiently clear and comprehensible that someone actually understands the case against them? And if they wish to say that it's wrong, that they are able to challenge.
Now, you're suggesting that there might be some sort of internationally recognized regime of process when sanctions are coming down. I mean, is that the case? Do you get a notification? You have 60 days to respond to these international sanctions, or otherwise you're going to go on this list and then your assets are going to be frozen. And if you can't come up with the documents that you challenged them or filled them out or even opened the letter or something like that, you're stuck.
Well, here's where it depends which regime you're talking about, because people talk about international sanctions, but actually usually the decision makers that impose sanctions are either the US or the European Union, or sometimes the United Nations, and the particular process that's followed and the way in which it's possible to challenge a sanctioning really depends which of those regimes we are talking about. But each of them has its own rules of due process. And in no regime I know of do they give advance notice that they're going to put you on a sanctions list, for the very simple reason that the idea is the purpose of these asset freezing measures is to freeze your assets. And if you're told in advance that you might be listed, there is a risk that, of course, you will dissipate your assets.
So how can you ever have due process in a case where there's never any notification?
Well, there is notification, but it's not notification in advance. So what used to happen in the case of the United Nations, for example, is that you would be added to the blacklist, which happened in very large numbers of people just after 9/11. Many people were added at the request of the United States to the Al-Qaeda Taliban UN list, without being given any reasons at all and without individual notification. Now, that is no longer the case. Now what happens in the European Union, and I think in the US, is that you are told, you are informed either by a letter or by some kind of public notice that you have been added to the list, and you are told, or you should be told, why. So you're given some kind of reasons. And the question that really the courts have been struggling with, particularly in the European Union, is what kind of reasons are sufficient? So how detailed do they have to be? Do they have to be supported by evidence and so on?
All right. So I'm a billionaire. And I know we can't really do this. Okay. But I've got to go down this road. I'm a billionaire. I live outside of Moscow in some dacha. And I've received some disturbing information. And I reach out to you. From your perspective as a lawyer, what's an easy sanction to get around? And what's something much more difficult? And counsel me, if you would.
Well, it depends what you mean by get around. I mean, we do two things. So one is we advise people on what exactly they are allowed to do and not allowed to do when they're on a sanctions list.
Right. So can I sail my boat out of the Mediterranean?
Well, it depends on which sanction we're talking about. At the moment, if we're talking about Russia, then what you're not allowed to do is have funds or any kind of economic resource made available to you in the European Union, and all of your existing funds held in the European Union are frozen, so you're not allowed to have access to them. And it would be a criminal offence for anyone to make funds available to you in the European Union. So there is nothing stopping you sailing your boat around Russia. The difficulty will come if you are someone who has been blacklisted. The restrictions are on what you can do when you're in the European Union or what EU citizens can provide you with. Now, if we were talking about, you know, Iranian citizens, then sanctions have gone much further, both in the US and the EU, than simply asset freezes. So there you would be in a much trickier situation where we'd be advising you on, if you wished to route a transaction from an Iranian bank to a European bank, that's a very, very difficult thing to do now. But at the moment, as I say, if it's Russia, you simply cannot hold funds in the EU or have funds available to you.
Can I send my wife or my girlfriend to an ATM in Geneva?
Well, Switzerland is not in the European Union.
Right, okay. All right, good point.
That always catches people out. Well, usually now in the EU, people's family members are not automatically themselves listed. There has to be some good reason to put people's family members on the list. But certainly someone's spouse would not be able to go to the European Union and make funds available in London for the benefit of someone on one of those lists without being in danger of committing a crime.
What if my company has been seized on some level and I want to keep paying my workers?
Well, there has been so far very limited blacklisting of companies. The difficulty comes with dealing with companies where people who are on the list have a large interest in the company. So in other words, either what can happen is the EU can add, say, a bank or a company to the list. If they do that, then that company is under the same restrictions as I've just outlined for people. But there is also now a great danger of dealing with companies where they haven't themselves been listed, But say there is an oligarch on the list who has a great degree of ownership or control in the company, then again, they need to do their due diligence and find out whether a Russian company that they are dealing with is owned or controlled by someone on the list. Because if they are, then their sanctions will also bite to prevent people dealing with companies where listed people have an interest. And the same is true with U.S. sanctions.
Has this sanctions universe created an opportunity for some offshore banking system that really services people like this, that either is a problem or a help in your work?
I'm not aware of that. I do think what tends to happen is that if, for example, the EU imposes sanctions on, say, an African country or Iran or any particular country, it's quite natural that what that country will try and do is make sure that its trade is not disturbed. And that may involve that country doing a lot more trade with different countries. You know, I have heard that China, for example, is a beneficiary of some of the sanctions that the European Union has imposed, because a country subject to sanctions will say, fine, we can't easily do business with the EU, we'll do business with the Far East instead. So I think it's less a question of, you know, particular banking or tax havens, and more that flows of trade will naturally be affected by sanctions.
So the takeaway is, sanctions, from your perspective, work?
The question is, work to do what? One of the concerns I have about sanctions, or one of the interesting things, is that you have to think about what are they actually trying to do. And what strikes me is that they are a pretty blunt instrument, namely usually asset freezes and travel bans, which are used as a way of foreign policy for countries like US or EU countries to try and avoid putting troops on the ground. But what they're trying to achieve is so disparate. So if you think about stopping the funding of terrorism, or trying to persuade a country to abide by the rule of law, or trying to persuade President Putin to act differently in Ukraine, or trying to stop nuclear proliferation, or even returning assets to Egypt. These are such different foreign policy goals that it's extremely difficult to measure whether sanctions are working or not working. And I'm really more concerned with whether sanctions are, when they're targeted at individuals, whether they do so in a fair way, rather than really whether they achieve their goal.
Maya Lester, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So even sanctioned oligarchs need lawyers, and if you are an oligarch on a target list, there is clearly someone you can call. Maya Lester is a Yale Law School graduate and a British lawyer specializing in sanctions. By the way, she's the daughter of a human rights attorney and an immigration judge. In a moment, a young Ukrainian man grapples with what is worth fighting for in his country, knowing that he may be drafted. Do you know what you are willing to fight for? Pamela says freedom of religion, freedom to own property, freedom of speech, freedom to travel anywhere in the USA without question, freedom of education, freedom to have children, freedom to vote. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're looking for your fighting words. Follow Pamela to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. Recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube. All on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
And now a young man who's been watching the headlines out of his homeland carefully and who has a decision to make. The announcement from the Ukrainian government of a reinstatement of the draft for 18 to 25-year-olds to deal with, quote, the deteriorating situation in the east and south of Ukraine felt like a personal message to 24-year-old Yuri Dedula. He is from Ukraine, the town of Lviv in western Ukraine, a virtual arm's reach from the borders of independent Slovakia, Poland, and Hungary. He's been working and studying here in the United States, but these days he can't escape the question, what is worth fighting for? When he leaves Washington, D.C. for home in a few weeks or months, he believes his life will change forever. Yuri Dedula says despite some misgivings, he's going home to be drafted and fight for Ukraine, a decision he has not even shared with his mother.
I will be drafted into an army when I am back in Ukraine. If Russian invasion does happen, guerrilla war is inevitable. I do have to say I am facing a dilemma. If, for example, Russia had withdrawn their troops from Ukraine now and Ukrainian government was conducting any kind of conversation or agreements with the Eastern Ukrainians who are in some way discontent with what's going on in Ukraine, I am definitely sure that we would have found a solution. But because Russia is sending their military, their militia into Ukraine and sending arms, sending financial help, that's where the difficulty is. Because it's impossible for Ukrainian government to find any kind of diplomatic solution in this case. Because they are strictly following Kremlin's scenario. And if those demands of federalization and separatism were actually genuine from Eastern Ukrainians, I would have totally agreed for them to separate. But I know they're not. Because according to recent polls, only 15% of Ukrainians in Eastern Ukraine are actually supporting the idea of federalization.
All right, but you can play around with the numbers. But is this worth picking up a gun for, in your mind?
That's my dilemma. I think that it's not only about Ukraine. It's about Russia as an aggressor and Russia as a country who basically ignores the current borders that were established by the post-Second World War agreements. I think it's not important only for Ukraine. It's important for the Western world, for the international community, to prevent this from happening. Because if we do accept Crimea, if we do accept Eastern Ukraine, there are Baltic states, there is Moldova, there is Belarus, there are some Central Asian countries who are fearing that if Russia can just go in and annex an independent country, it could do the same to those countries too.
But Yuri, you were a part of the protests last time you were back in Ukraine, right?
Yes.
When you were in those crowds there in Maidan, were you chanting for the people of Kazakhstan and the Baltics that if you hold the line here that they'll be protected? Or was it about something really different when you were there in those crowds?
Well, I must say that when I did go back to Kyiv for the protests, I came back to a totally different country. Last time I was in Kyiv, I didn't feel this Ukrainian spirit. This time when I went back, although most of the protesters were Russian-speaking, I felt that they're all pro-European, they're all pro-Ukrainian. They just wanted a different life. They're tired of corruption, they're tired of inequality, of social injustice, and that's what it was all about. It doesn't matter what language you speak to be a Ukrainian. And the only fact that people stood up against this greediness, I think this is a different Ukraine now. And people created this new, strong civic society that will now keep the government accountable. And Ukrainians now have a very optimistic future. And Russia understands that. Putin understands that if Ukraine goes to a better direction, goes towards European values, then this might happen in Russia.
Well, Yuri, Putin's interests here are pretty clear. And I think you've stated them well. But if you were in those protests and people wanted to get rid of corruption, is putting you, a 24-year-old Ukrainian, in front of bullets the best way to get rid of corruption?
Well, today the circumstances changed and I'm being put against Russia not to fight corruption but to protect our independence. Because Ukrainians fought for independence for centuries. And now that we got it, Russia is trying to take it away again. And it's an eternal conflict between Ukrainian identity and Russian identity of being an older brother, of kind of protecting us from Europeanism, from capitalism. And they don't want to let Ukraine go, because if they lose Ukraine, the whole idea of reestablishing the Soviet Union will be a fail. Because without Ukraine, it doesn't work.
What are you most afraid of here?
I am the most afraid of people losing lives. For me, life is the biggest gift from God, and I really value everybody's lives. So that's
including
my biggest
own
dilemma. Yes, and I am scared to go into a battlefield, not only because I can't fight, but also because I'm afraid, I'm not willing to kill, because I know the people who will be fighting there, they're not doing this because they want to, but because they are being told to and because they're being brainwashed that this is what they should do.
So, Yuri, last question. Are you absolutely sure this is your fight?
Yes, I am sure, because this is the fight for our country. This is the fight for peace in the world. Because if, I mean, as I told you before, this is not only about Ukraine. This is about Russia, who is openly lying to everybody. They're openly lying to American delegations. They're openly lying in the UN meetings. They're lying about everything that is happening in Ukraine. And that's, I think it's kind of hypocritical of Western diplomats to talk about democracy, to talk about international order, about freedom, and keep up with this.
All right, so I'm convinced you believe that this is your fight. Good luck, bud.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Draft age Yuri Dudula is a 24-year-old Ukrainian on his way home, he says, to fight. He currently works for the U.S.-based National Endowment for Democracy. Earlier today, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov again accused the West and the government in Kiev of manipulating the situation. And Lavrov had this to say about the people in Ukraine. Young Yuri Dudula may be fighting.
Those who protest against the authorities in the southeast of Ukraine, they want their voice to be heard. Holding elections in a situation where you use your armed forces against a fraction of a civilian population is unusual. It's not Afghanistan where we have an ongoing war and elections taking place.
What would you fight for? Call us at 877-8MYTAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com.
As the horrified people of Nigeria grapple with the kidnapping of more than 250 young schoolgirls and the announcement this week from the terrorist group Boko Haram that the girls will be sold as slaves, the people of the Democratic Republic of Congo are dealing with a similar case of their own. The long civil war in Congo has devastated the country and resulted in lawlessness and sexual violence under the cover of chaos. Eventually, 39 soldiers, including 13 officers, stood trial for raping perhaps 130 women in the town of Minova, in the largest rape case and trial in the country's history, and the first time the Congolese government has ever paid for a war-related sexual violence trial. But just two of the 39 accused soldiers were convicted. Global Post correspondent Alicia Stokes recently returned from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Welcome.
Thank you.
How is this verdict going to be accepted or not accepted by the people of Congo at this point? This has been a very, very widely watched trial.
You know, it's difficult to speculate on how this verdict will be received within the Congo. Support for the Congolese military is very high right now after the defeat of the M23 rebel group. People are experiencing relative peace right now, and they're happy about that. At the same time, it's hard to believe that the victims of this crime will feel anything but neglect. They were not present at the trial yesterday, and so they're going to learn of the verdict in the coming weeks.
What has been the role of the victims in both the trial and in making this case public?
You know, the victims have really been the backbone of the trial. There were 56 women who actually went to testify during the trial, and they were giving testimony, giving evidence, explaining what happened in Minova during that 10-day spree of violence with great courage and, some would say, with some risk to their own well-being.
And the American Bar Association has put 1,000 as the number of rape victims, even though the United Nations puts it at a much smaller number. And indeed, the trial relates to about 130 victims. It seems almost impossible to have justice in a situation where the number of victims ranges so widely.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about rape in a country where rape is shameful. So I think it's very difficult for women and also men who also experience rape in Congo to come forward and speak about these crimes. I don't think we'll ever know exactly how many people were raped in Minova. The United Nations is generally conservative on their estimates of sexual violence, and so it's impossible to say.
Is there any way to know what will happen to the two convicted defendants?
Yes, they're going to go to prison. The two who are convicted for rape will go to prison for life, and that means their entire lives. It's not the same as in America and our justice system. And the remaining men, most of them were convicted of robbing and pillaging, and so they will also be in prison for 10 years, which will provide the victims with some measure of satisfaction, I imagine.
I want you to listen to this here. It's something that you know pretty well here. It's from one of the victims, known only as F-64.
Someone came and touched the side of my tent, and he entered the house. When he was touching me, I was afraid.
Alicia, how much courage does it take for someone to come forth with an accusation like that, given what you know about the Democratic Republic of Congo?
Well, that's actually a clip from a film I recently shot for Global Post. And I just want to point out that F-64 did that, and she was somewhat identifiable in that film, and that was her decision. She wanted to take ownership for her story and her experience. And I have to say that takes tremendous amount of courage. What so impressed me about F-64 and all of these women was that they wanted to be at the forefront of the fight for women's rights in Congo. They were adamant that this was just not about justice for them. This was about justice for all women. And they spoke with dignity, and it was very impressive.
Alicia Stokes recently returned from the Democratic Republic of Congo. She's a correspondent for the Global Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's primary season. Contests in Ohio, Indiana, and North Carolina may define the GOP agenda this year and give a clue on which party will control the U.S. Senate after November. But here's a bit of democracy crossed with quantum physics. A candidate running for Congress in two districts in two states, like an entangled quark, he's in two places at once, only in America, right? Republican Alan Levine tried to get on the ballot in four places. He's running for Congress in Georgia and Hawaii. It's completely legal, and Levine says not really that hard to do.
The qualifications are fairly simple. In Georgia's instance, you give the Georgia Republican Party a little bit over $5,000, and then you're on the ballot. In the other states, you have to collect signatures and provide some money. And the collection of signatures is probably the most difficult, or has been the most difficult, in the Midwest, because the Midwest winter, as you know, has been brutal. So that was a major problem that we had.
And did you choose these districts based on the weather? No.
No, not at all. First of all, there was a series of filters. The first filter is that the district was open. We recognized that if there's an incumbent, the chances are that incumbent would stay the incumbent. So we were wasting our time and money. So we chose four states that we thought we could win in, depending on circumstance. All four were open seats.
So the ad would go like this: wanted, open congressional district in place favoring Republican, willing to relocate. And suddenly you are on the ballot in the 11th district in Georgia, and which district in Hawaii?
The first congressional district. We're not actually on the ballot yet. We've met the signature collection requirements in Hawaii, but we're not going to actually submit the papers until after the primary in Georgia. And the rationale for this is pretty straightforward once you delve into it, which is I want to either win or lose in Georgia, preferably win, because, frankly, I like Georgia a lot. I love the people, and I want to stay. But running in multiple states is a means to an end, and the end is getting a vote in Congress to fix our economy. If I win in Georgia, then I would not submit the papers in Hawaii. If I lose in Georgia, then there is time, because of the peculiar primary dates across the entire country, which have different primaries and different paper submissions in each state. So we're going to put the papers in shortly thereafter.
All right. So your message to the people in the district that you might be running in is one thing, but your general message to people in any district you might be running is just to get Alan Levine into Congress because he's a voice for prosperity. How do you make that work with specific local messages tailored to the people in the 11th district, for instance?
If I only wanted to represent the 11th district or a subset thereof, I would have run for the Georgia State Senate or the Georgia House. But our problems are national in scope. So I can easily represent the 11th District, and I can easily represent Hawaii's 1st Congressional District, because people are people. And the underlying fact is that people want well-paying jobs. They want secure employment, and they want to be able to support their family, and that's national in scope.
What do you think this shows about America, that the bar is low for getting into Congress? Do you think this is a loophole in the law that you're trying to exploit? Should more people take advantage of this to exercise their civic duty and to get civically engaged? What are your thoughts?
The country is in trouble. Albert Einstein once said that the definition of madness is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome. And that's exactly what Congress people do. They do exactly the same thing over and over again, and nothing changes. I'm being very creative. Nobody's done this before. It is perfectly legal. It's within the it's actually defined in the Constitution that this can be done, and I'm doing it.
Alan Levine, good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Alan Levine is a Republican candidate for Congress in Georgia's 11th District and has the paperwork that he has yet to file to run for Congress in Hawaii's primary on August 9th. So the fight for the soul of the Republican Party may be playing out in primaries in North Carolina, Indiana, and Ohio, and they may give us clues about the chances of the GOP taking control of the U.S. Senate after November. New numbers released by the Pew Research Center show 65% of Americans say they want the president elected in 2016 to pursue different policies and programs than the Obama administration. And polling also shows the strongest tilt to Republican candidates at this point in a midterm year in at least 2 decades. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. So people feeling good there on Capitol Hill?
Feeling good. they know it's election day in 3 states, and it's a harbinger of lots and lots of primaries across the country in the month of May. So this is kind of the opening gun, John.
So it's Fort Sumter for the Tea Party or Custer's last stand in these tests around the country?
And that's one of the big questions that's going on in Republican land and in some Democratic circles as well. The Tea Party candidates and conservative candidates, read anti-Republican establishment candidates, haven't managed to knock off any Republican incumbents so far. And there are a couple of races today that might be interesting in that regard. Even though, you know, John, I got to say, overall, the House races this year aren't terribly interesting for a lot of people because there's such a low chance that the House is going to flip. It's going to stay Republican. And even if Republicans gain 5 seats or Democrats gain 6 seats, it's really the Senate people are most interested in. But the power of Tea Party candidates and conservative-funded candidates against the Republican establishment remains interesting and remains very important. In the North Carolina 3rd District, Walter Jones is a Republican. He's a libertarian Republican incumbent against the Iraq War, anti-war guy, but he's got a Sarah Palin backed challenger, a fellow named Taylor Griffin, who's a former Hill staffer, who we all remember. And people are sort of watching that race. Walter Jones may be one of the incumbents who could get knocked off. Hey, you know who else has a Tea Party challenger today, John? John Boehner over
really?
In Ohio. Yeah,
no kidding.
His district. Now, nobody thinks Boehner's going to lose, but he has had to spend money on ads in this cycle for the first time in 4 or 6 years. So Boehner's got a Tea Party challenger, too, but he'll get through.
Any backlash from the government shutdown or the debt limit crisis, those sorts of issues that really played out over the last year and a half?
And the interesting thing that has people scratching their heads or say, you know, memories really are short in politics, is that the government shutdown and the debt limit fight, which was supposed to be A, toxic for Republicans against Democrats because people hate that kind of dysfunction, or toxic for establishment Republicans who voted to open the government back up. They were supposed to be really vulnerable to Tea Party challengers who were mad that, hey, you didn't back Ted Cruz, you didn't back Tom Lee in this fight. We like those guys. That hasn't materialized so far, And you may have to wait for some of the Senate fights to see if that dynamic really plays out. So far, it hasn't. And that's made people wonder if the Tea Party is losing some of its oomph, losing some of its ability to knock off incumbents, or is it the case, like maybe in this North Carolina primary, that a lot of the establishment Republican candidates have co-opted the conservative, the Tea Party ideas, and so they're not as distinguishable anymore. And it's hard for the outsiders to get traction because the Republicans are not acting like them.
So rule one in the Zwillick Book of Politics is Americans have short memories. So I'm wondering if Representative Trey Gowdy, Republican of South Carolina, is making a bad bet here on Benghazi. Listen.
Can you tell me why Chris Stevens was in Benghazi the night that he was killed? Do you know? Does it bother you whether or not you know why Chris Stevens was in Benghazi? Do you know why we were the last flag flying in Benghazi after the British had left and the Red Cross had been bombed? Do you know why requests for additional security were denied?
Now, he's talking to the press there. I'm wondering if anyone out in America, according to the polls, is listening.
Well, does Trey Gowdy sound like a prosecutor to you? Because that's exactly what he is, in addition to being a congressman from South Carolina, and was just appointed by Speaker John Boehner to head up a new congressional inquiry commission about the attacks in Benghazi and the media management aftermath from the White House. John, you asked about short memories. Republicans want to make sure that this issue at Benghazi, which is completely partisan now, conservative Republicans think it's dire. There have even been the I word mentioned in some places.
Impeachment.
Democrats think that it's a waste of time. They roll their eyes. They say it was a tragedy, but there's no there. Republicans know this is an issue to get the base out. It gets people angry and gets them to the polls. This is a midterm election. And your prosecutor there, Trey Gowdy from South Carolina, will be the head of the new congressional inquiry.
What about Obamacare? 8 million signed up. That was the huge issue that the Republicans were counting on running on. Are we going to see Obamacare ads and get that all tested in terms of voter turnout in these primaries?
You will, and you already are. Look, nothing has changed in terms of the fact that Republicans are primarily running against Obamacare, but you have seen subtle shifts in some races of Republicans, especially in states where a lot of people signed up, still saying they want to change the law. The law is flawed. They want to, you know, my opponent doesn't want to change the law, but they're not necessarily talking about repeal in some places. There's been a subtle shift there.
All right. So what do you look for? North Carolina, Indiana, and Ohio, what's the most important before we go?
We're looking to see who wins the North Carolina Republican primary to take on Democrat Kay Hagan. She's vulnerable. There's a Tea Party. There are three candidates, Tom Tillis, Greg Brandon, and Pastor Mark Harris, all backed by different factions of Republicans. Look for one thing. Does Tom Tillis get the 40% he needs to avoid a runoff and take on Kay Hagan? She's really vulnerable, and she's on the front line of the Republican bid to take over the Senate.
That's the number. Watching North Carolina, Indiana, and Ohio. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it.
You gotta fight for your right to party.
The Beastie Boys fighting for the right to party, a right not in the U.S. Constitution. Whose rights would you fight for?
Right now, LGBT rights are at the top of my list, and also women's rights. And I'm not sure about fighting for my country. I'm sure I'm happy with the do-nothing obstructionist Congress, especially Republicans, but both sides. Well, actually, I'd fight for my country, even as unhappy as I am right now.
Alina from Seattle calling into 877-8-MY-TAKE. Patrick would fight for freedom of information, ideas, and education, something that is dwindling way too much around the world. The conversation on all this, what would you fight for, continues at facebook.com/thetakeaway. And up next, truth, justice, and the American way.
Part of why I wrote this book and called it The True American is because I don't think it's so straightforward what a true American is. These are two deep veins of thinking in America, and one has to do with kind of preserving your culture and keeping things as they are, and another has to do with constant churn. And I actually think part of what makes America great is getting that balance right between how much you change and how much you keep.
Anand Giridharadas, author of The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. That's coming up here on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people. Created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
We leave you this hour with a story of freedom and a remarkable decision by someone who nearly died in a lone American's war on terror. 10 days after the 9/11 attacks, a Texas auto body repairman and self-styled white supremacist freedom fighter named Mark Stroman walked into a gas station just outside Dallas and shot the man behind the counter in the face, a Bangladeshi immigrant named Rais Buyan. Buyan survived, but two other people shot by Stroman did not. The shooting put Stroman on death row and set Rais Buyan on a journey that would end in a fight to forgive his attacker and get him off death row. Journalist Anand Giridharadas says this story is really about a divided America fighting to be free of the hatred and anger that sometimes lurks below the surface. Anand is a columnist for our partner, The New York Times. His book is called The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas.
When I heard about this story of a convenience store clerk, a Muslim immigrant from Bangladesh, shot by a white supremacist in Texas after 9/11, and then the immigrant 10 years later forgives his attacker, the deeper I got into this story, which kind of just intrigued me, I realized that it was a collision between these two Americas.
Rais Buyan survived the attack. He's the person who remade himself, as you tell the story in this book. But he'd already remade himself, coming from anything but humble origins in Bangladesh. I mean, he had a terrific career, but just no way to practice it. And he had to humble himself to do what he ended up doing as a convenience store clerk in the United States.
You know, I remember I once read a book about how there's a gene that you often find in people who do bungee jumping and other crazy things. And the book made the argument that Americans had the highest kind of proportion of this gene in the population than any other country in the world. Because America is full of these people or descendants of people who maybe have perfectly good situations, as Rais did. An Air Force officer in his country. He was never going to drive his own car. He was going to be chauffeured around for the rest of his life. He was going to have country club memberships, be a senior military officer, be at the height of respect. But something in him, that kind of bungee jumping gene, let's call it, always wanted more, and more in his case, as in so many people's cases around the world, meant America.
Bungee jumping in Dallas and coming face to face with Mark Stroman, who for many people in the world, despite America's reputation as being a place where you can remake yourself, Mark Stroman is also the image of America around the world. Where does that image come from and where does it fit in this story?
In many ways, Mark Stroman is a aberration. I mean, he's a, you know, anybody who walks into three gas stations as he did and shoots three people is very much his own situation. But at a deeper level, I think it would be wrong to see him only as an aberration because he did grow out of a context. And in many ways, that's a context of a white working class in particular that economically, culturally was in many ways the backbone of this country. When you look at movies and music, we still think of this kind of semi-rural, ex-urban white America as kind of the heartland. And in a great many places, that heartland is failing, falling apart. And he grew out of that heartland that is failing and falling apart. But it's not just Mark Stroman. It's the life his kids are now living. It's the life everybody he knows. One of the funny things was, not funny, but you know, there are several thousand pages of legal documents that come out of any capital murder trial, which is what he had. And they're just a bunch of names from his childhood of his friends sprinkled into this long record, people he was arrested for, you know, driving around in someone else's pickup truck with when he was 12 and little things like that. And almost any name I ran through the internet was also a violent criminal later convicted of very, very serious crimes. Mm-hmm. So if you were hanging, if you were in his social world and hanging with him when you were 12, it was a pretty done deal that you were going to end up being a violent criminal. So what blew my mind was that this is a social universe. This is white, ex-urban America. And you have a social structure that is completely in tatters. You have, in some cases, a lack of work, although Mark Stroman never had that problem. The word family, which we all continue to use as though nothing has changed, nobody in that world has a family. Now, this is something where we don't talk about it in America because the left doesn't want to talk about it for one set of reasons. The right only wants to talk about it in one very narrow way. And so we just agree not to talk about it.
The prosecutors in the Stroman case went out of their way to get the death penalty and really almost ideologically made the point that this is not America. This trial for them was about his hatred is not America. And so therefore, they sought the death penalty. Do you agree with that?
in his case, the notion that there's only one idea of America is obviously an absurd idea. And part of what was so beautiful about what the prosecutors argued was that Mark Stroman, who called himself the true American, was, you know, a false prophet of the idea of a true American, and that it was these immigrants who loved America enough, as the prosecutor said, to leave where they were and come here, to choose it, not just inherit it, who also embodied a certain true American spirit. But I have to say, part of why I wrote this book and called it The True American is because I don't think it's so straightforward what a true American is. One of these characters may be a lot more likable than the other, but in some ways, these are two deep veins of thinking in America, and one has to do with kind of preserving your culture and keeping things as they are, and another has to do with constant churn. And I actually think part of what makes America great is getting that balance right between how much you change and how much you keep.
Do you think Reis Bouillon, in the end, as part of his forgiveness, could see the pain that Mark Stroman was in this world that you investigated as a journalist, and could see that his dreams weren't being realized and that he could really relate to that?
He did. And you know, in his own life, he spent a lot of time thinking about what he could do. First, he came to the conclusion on a pilgrimage to Mecca that God had saved him and he needed to repay God. But it took him time to figure out how. And his conclusion was his way of intervening as a kind of Muslim immigrant in America was to say, not only do I not hate the person who did this to me, who left me blind in one eye, who left 39 pellets in my face forever, not only do I not hate you, I forgive you. I understand that you had a very limited opportunity to become anything other than what you became. And towards the end of this story, Reis Bouillon starts to invest money and time in Mark Stroman's children and see if he can help at least one American family get out of this cycle of poverty and ignorance and hatred and self-hatred.
I sense in this book that you're really fighting to make sure people get it about what you're talking about here. What's your fight in this book?
I will say unambiguously that this is the most extraordinary country in the world. But there's a great number of us in this country, right alongside the rest of us, who are already living in second and third world conditions. And this duality of a country that still manages to be world-beating in so much that it does and still manages to have so many people who are living that way and cannot figure out how to connect them, connect that promise and capacity and hope to all the people who are no longer living that way. That's my fight.
Anand Giridharadas, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
He's the author of The True American: Murder and Mercy in Texas, and is a columnist for our partner, The New York Times. So many stories about fighting and forgiveness. Join the conversation at thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.